Pastor John back with us. He'll be speaking on Genesis 23, verse 7 to 20. The grave is the door to the land.
Well, good morning to all of you, and thanks, Edward, for that awesome time of worship. It's so good to see you back in church, and thank you for joining us on Zoom, and thank you for sitting right behind. Next Sunday, that last row will be no more. All right, so enjoy it while you can. All right. So good to be back, and so good to have Edward leading us in worship again. It's so refreshed, recharged, and that was great. This morning, we continue on the second part of chapter 23 of Genesis. And if you remember, we did talk a bit about death. And I didn't want to oversimplify it or to make you feel like I'm not afraid of death. You know, we are all conscious and tense, and because none of us have died before, all right? Very few, only probably Lazarus. And Jesus, after dying, he came back and he can tell us what death is all about. But for us, because even as born again, we know we are going to go to heaven, but there is this concern. But what is troubling is that if you are afraid, then something is wrong. If you are unwilling to die, then something is very wrong, because you don't think of heaven as your home. And the reason I suggested was that because you have not been spending enough time there. Just that you're spending a lot of time in your home. You're very familiar, comfortable, and you love to be home. But why is it that we do not think of heaven as home? Now, like I've said, I'm not in a hurry to die. And I'm not even suggesting that you should fall sick intentionally and then die and then go to heaven quickly. No, no. That's not biblical even. We do need to take care of our bodies, the one that God gave us, by eating and exercising sensibly. Sensibly. That's the operative word. But we must not be obsessed by the desire to be healthy, so much so that we spend hours and hours and hours in the gym every day, and you eat only organic food and brown rice. I know of people who bring brown rice to the restaurant and have the restaurant cook the brown rice for them. I think that's crazy. Because for me, after 67 years, it's just too late to eat organic food. It's the amount of rubbish I put into this body is beyond repair. So it's too late for me anyway. But if I'm sick, do I want to be healed? Yes, of course. Yes, I want to get well again. So what do I do? First, I pray. I pray to Jesus to heal me. Then after that, I go to see a doctor, trusting Jesus to use the doctor to heal me. What if I'm terminally ill? One day, I may be terminally ill. What should I do? I will also first pray. Pray for Jesus to heal me miraculously. And even if that didn't work, and when I'm on my deathbed, I will still trust Jesus because he is God. Remember, when Jesus came, he was healing the sick. Not because he was interested in our physical well-being only, but he was using that to illustrate to us that his real interest was to heal us spiritually. Spiritually, that's more important, because you remember that even after Jesus healed Lazarus or raised Lazarus from the dead, eventually Lazarus died again. And we will all die one day. But in the meantime, the question is, how are you going to spend the time God is giving you on this earth? How are you going to spend the time that God has given you? And for that, we certainly can learn from the lives of so many godly people. There's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and David in the Old Testament. And there's Paul and Peter in the New Testament. And the greatest amongst them is Jesus. And it is still Jesus. So, in our study, with the death of Sarah, Abraham approached the elders of the Hittites to get their approval to buy a piece of land for a burial site. And we saw in verse 6 how the negotiation began with the elders speaking. And before we begin, we need to remember also that in the days of Abraham, their world was pretty developed and well organized. It was a well organized society, not what we usually imagine them to be, like nomadic Bedouins walking around in the desert with their sheep and their camels. It's not just that. Yes, they were living in tents for Abraham, but for the most part, many are living in big cities with water, lighting, not electricity, but it was very comfortable, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. And how Lot was attracted to those cities, but not Abraham. So before we begin, let's just look to God in prayer. Father, we want to thank you this morning that we could come before you in your presence to open your word. And we ask that as you speak to us, may we be teachable. And as your spirit helps us to understand, may we personalize it and then depend on you to energize us to walk a life of obedience, so that it will be pleasing to you. And truly, that's what we want to do, to please you. And we ask this in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. In verse 6, the elders of the Hittites assured Abraham that because he was so highly respected, he can choose any of their burial sites, the best if he wanted to, and none would refuse him. And it sounded to us as if they were going to give to Abraham for free. But we know that's not true. It was just their culture. It was their way of saying, we are willing to sell you the land. And to arrive at the final price, obviously, there's a great deal of negotiation going on, bargaining back and forth. But we did say that It is not wrong to negotiate, to bargain, to haggle. It's not wrong. But the problem with the Hittite culture was that they used this subtle form of politeness that goes into covering up their greed. And you and I will see today that they are truly masters of deception. Masters of deception. And that's one of the lessons we need to take away today. That in our words, when we speak, we need to be sincere, honest. And even though we are at a disadvantage, we need to honor those words. And the worst part with this culture is that they have gone into this deception. They're so good at it, at today what we will call scamming other people. And we understand that in all cultures, and that's where we have to be careful. Sometimes we say things we don't really mean. That's dangerous. It's kind of like I've had that many times. People walking up to me and say, "How are you?" And then they walk away because they are not interested to know how are you. You know, all right. You can say, "Oh, today I feel lousy and I feel like putting my head in a bag and dig a hole and crawl in." They are not interested. They just ask, "How are you?" And then they walk away. Another interesting example was what my sister told me. In Australia, when she got there, she was new. And when one day at her workplace, somebody came up to say, "Hey, I'd like to invite you for my birthday lunch." And she thought, "Wow, okay. All right, let's go. All right." And she went for the lunch. They brought presents and all that. And after the lunch, they were all expected to pay for their own lunches. And it's kind of a something strange for us. Because if I were to say to you, "Hey, I want to invite you for lunch," means I'm paying. But in their culture, it was different. So cultures differ. And we're going to see how this Hittite culture in their negotiation dance, how it looks like. Verse 7. "Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. Verse 8, he said to them, 'If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf.'" Verse 9, "So he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you." In these three verses, again, Abraham showed that even though he was highly respected, he stood up. The Bible says he stood up and he bowed down as a sign of respect to the Hittites. Let me just mention here very quickly. Every single word that the Bible says, every single word that God says has a purpose. He doesn't put it there for fun. And I think we need to learn something here. When you respect somebody, you stand up. And Abraham was already not just his elderly, but he's rich and powerful. He stood up and bowed down. And today, if you and I were to remember, many times when we speak to people, sometimes we are at the table eating and somebody walked up to us, it is only polite to stand up and talk. All right? To me, I think it's very rude to sit down and look up and talk. You need to stand up. It doesn't matter how old you are, you stand up. And he bowed down before the people of the land. The people, not just the elders. He didn't just bow down to the elders. He bowed down to the people also. And he said something to them. If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron on my behalf. Which means that he's approaching the elders. And then he named the owner and the location of the burial site he wanted, implying that Abraham already has done his research. He knows what he wants. He's prepared. He came prepared. And he asked for the cave of Machpelah, which was located at the end corner of the field. And Abraham wants to buy the cave, and he insisted on paying the full market price. Now, Machpelah is a name of a place, a place. The field is in Machpelah, and the cave is at the end of the field. We're going to take a look at the place, the cave, all right? And you will be surprised even to understand the meaning of the word Machpelah is so rich. And if you were to look at the cartoon, normally I try to find something that is relevant. This is the best picture I can find. Machpelah is a cave, yes. It seems like there is only one entrance. But when you go into the entrance, there are actually two caves. Machpelah means double cave or split cave. You will understand a bit more when we get to it. But in the meantime, we need to remember that the other thing that Abraham made very clear was not only he wanted to buy, and he knows the place, the exact spot he wanted, but he's willing to pay the full price. He wasn't asking for a discount or a favor, because you would remember that Abraham, even after he fought the four Babylonian kings, and he came back, he didn't want anything. The king of Sodom offered him to share the treasures. And he says, I will not even take one shoelace from you, so that nobody can say that you made me rich. Wow, that's faith. And I wonder how many of us think like that. When we have the opportunity to grab money, we grab. But not Abraham, because Abraham didn't want the Hittites to think that they are doing him a favor. And he didn't even ask for a discount. And here we have an important principle. In all our dealings, whether outside in the secular world or here in the church, we must not owe anybody any favor. We know God says, owe no man anything except love. So, Evelyn and I, we usually enjoy having you guys taking us out for meals and all that. But we make it a point to return the favor. We make it a point. All right? And we appreciate a lot of the love that you guys have shown us. And this is where we can learn an important principle from Abraham. And he asked for this specific cave, Machpelah. And this is where we're going to take a look, a tour of this place. And if you go to Hebron today, you will see this cave. This is taken from the air. And you can see that this complex is huge. You can see the people around here, and they are praying. They are praying whether to Abraham or hoping that Abraham can help them. And they are all praying here. Can you see the amount of people here? This complex is huge. But there is another photo which I think is better. Up here, this is where the graves are. But hold your horses, because I'm going to explain to you. It is all, there are only six people buried inside there, and they are all buried inside here. And then over time, they built walls around it. Now, there's another photo which I think is better. Take a look. All right. So it gives you an idea, the surrounding, how big this is, and it is on a slope going up. All right. But this little house here is not so little. This is where the entrance of the cave is. And the entrance of the cave is actually going down into the ground. It is not like a doorway this way and you walk through it. It is going down like into a tunnel. And the entrance is somewhere here, all right? And this was built by King Herod, because they studied the stone. And you can see there's a line here, and below here is actually the foundation. They raise up the ground so that they can flatten here, much like the Temple Mount, all right? And compared to the Temple Mount, this is of course very small, but this is the only structure built by King Herod that survived in its totality until today, right? So if you go there, maybe I should put it the other way, don't go, all right? Because if you go there, they won't let you in. It is actually a Muslim site, and it's controlled by them, and nobody can go in. So, but there were some pictures taken earlier. Let me show you to them. Inside, all right, you can see that little house is not that small. It is pretty high, all right? And in it, there are two strange looking, I don't know what you call it, but it houses the coffin. Take a look at the coffins. If you were to peek into there are windows by the side, I think. Don't know how they see it, but if you were to look inside, this is what you will see. All right. And they will say, this is the coffin of Abraham. And there are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their wives. And the wife does not include Rachel. I don't know why. But when we get to chapter 35, we'll understand why. But the interesting part about this is that archaeologists only found fairly recently the tunnel into the caves in 1981, right? Because they have already built the floor over it. In here, it is empty. There's no bones, there's no nothing in it. So archaeologists, when they went in, they found two caves, one larger one, and then further down, a smaller one. That's why it is called Machpelah. And they found nothing in those caves. Why? Anybody? Any ideas why they found nothing? It's supposed to be six people, because they all died 4,000 years ago. All right. 4,000 years ago compared to as it stands today. Abraham lived 2,000 years before Jesus, and we're living 2,000 years after Jesus. 4,000 years, right? So they found nothing. There was no marker, no tombstone that says, here is the grave of Abraham. All right. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Sarah, and I want to say Rebecca, and also Leah, right? Not Rachel. Do I have another photo? Nope. All right. Machpelah means a fold. A fold means you take a piece of paper or cloth, you fold. That Machpelah comes from the root word to fold together. It means double, to repeat the fold. It means you fold once and you fold twice, two folds. That is why the cave has come to be called a double cave or a split cave. The root word, kofal. Kofal is used only five times in the whole of the Old Testament. Five times. Out of these five times, four of it was used to refer to the breastplate that the high priest wears, because that cloth was folded twice and then sewn, and 12 precious stones are sewn onto it, and he had to wear this. And that 12 stones represents the 12 tribes of Israel. But there is only one that was used in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 21 verse 14, that speaks of the sword that Ezekiel says is going to come on the people of Jerusalem at the third deportation, when Nebuchadnezzar is going to slaughter everybody. But in that verse, God said to the sword, double it. Fold the sword. Why do you fold the sword? When you fold the sword, it means you don't kill. The sword cannot kill anymore. Meaning, God is going to preserve a remnant. A remnant. All right? A remnant. And this word is so, so significant, because it tells us here that in this cave, we're not going to find only six bodies. But these six bodies represent the whole nation of Israel that's going to come 400 years later. 400 years later. But the Hittites didn't know. And that is the significance of the meaning of the word double cave. It's not just one cave. The future nation of Israel is also in that cave. And here we see God preparing to give and to seal the land. To Abraham and his descendants. But the Hittites didn't know. And verses 10 and 11 of chapter 23 tells us, Ephron, the Hittite, was sitting among his people, and he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of his city. Verse 11, no, my Lord, he said, listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead. Those are very carefully chosen words that Efron just said. He was very well rehearsed. He practiced it all the time. And he's so good. But notice first here that he was not an elder. He was sitting amongst the people. And he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of his city. Meaning, in those days, and even during the time of Jesus, much of the official business is all done at the city gate. All right? So we find Lot sitting at the city gate. And here, Abraham came to meet the elders at the city gate. And Ephron's reply was, "Listen to me." And he called Abraham, "My Lord." He says, "No, no, 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 no. Don't pay me. I give it to you." But notice the first thing he said. He didn't say, "I give you the cave. Take it." He said what? "I give you the field." Abraham didn't want the field. He wanted only the cave. And here, he said three times, "I give you, I give you, I give you." And we know it was just a custom. He didn't mean it. But for him to offer the whole field to Abraham along with the cave sounds like, wow, this guy Ephron must be the nicest person on planet Earth. It's kind of like if you come up to me and say, "Pastor John, can you give me a ride to the city?" I say, "No, no, no. Take my car. All right? Have it. You keep the car." It's kind of like that. Or I go to your house and I say, "Can I stay, you know, one night in your place?" And you say, "No, no, 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 no. Take my house. Have it." All right? It's something like that. The Hittites must be the nicest people on planet Earth. But we know it's not true. And Ephron really had no intention to give away his property, especially to a wealthy foreigner like Abraham. But notice the first thing he said. What he meant was that he wants to sell the entire field. Don't think that he's generous. He wanted to sell the entire field. And we know that herein lies all these great Hittite business people. And this was only a clever maneuver to trap and force Abraham to buy the whole field, which he doesn't need. But the question, why? Why would he force Abraham to buy the whole field? And this is only the first part of the problem. The reason that Ephron wanted to sell the whole field was because under Hittite law says that when a landowner sold only part of his property to someone else, the original owner must continue to pay all the taxes on the whole land. So if Abraham were to own only the cave, Ephron would still have to continue to pay taxes on the whole field. So this is one of the reasons why Ephron is forcing Abraham to buy the whole field, not just the cave. Another question came to mind when I was studying was, why? Why did Abraham address only the elders first and not directly to Ephron because he was sitting there in the crowd. I think we can look at it in two ways. First is the elders were the officials of the city and they have the power to broker the sale. And that works for Abraham because Abraham was asking them to make this deal publicly so that it is legal and official. Legal and official. But I think what is more important here is God is showing us that the elders are also complicit in this scam that is about to take place. They were actually helping Ephron, their own people, to scam Abraham, pressuring him to buy the whole field. And we know later on, paying an overpriced for that piece of land. But it works for the elders too. Because if it works with an overpriced piece of land, it will force the price of land surrounding it to also go up. And it's good for the elders too. But what the elders didn't know is that now they are officially opening the door for Abraham and his descendants to own the land, even though it is going to be 400 years later. But we'll come back to that. Let's move on to verses 12 and 13. Verse 12. Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, "Listen to me, if you will, I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me so that I can bury my dead there." So once again, we know that there is this dance going on. There is this culture where both cannot lose face. And the seller wants to appear like he's so kind. "I give it to you. Take it." And the buyer must say, "No, no, no. It's not nice, you know." And he must decline politely. And here Abraham stood up again, bowed down, and thanked him and acknowledged his generous offer, even though Abraham knew that it wasn't sincere. While Abraham respected their culture, Abraham wasn't interested in dancing with them, playing their game any longer than necessary, because he only wanted to get a piece of land to bury his wife. So Abraham went straight to the point and agreed to pay for the entire field. And he insisted that he will pay the full price. Now, this insistence to pay is expected in their culture. But it was too quick. There was no dancing. And it must have been a shock to everybody then that Abraham gave up so quickly. There was no haggling. He didn't ask for a discount. And it shocked everyone at the city gate. And while it shocked them, this is truly a step of faith on Abraham's part. But sometimes we don't see that as a step of faith. And we don't think of Abraham as a savvy businessman or even a good negotiator. We would love to have a great time bargaining, isn't it? And then when we get our price, then we walk away so happy. But we don't think of Abraham that way because we've forgotten. We've forgotten that it was Abraham who bargained with God for Sodom and for his nephew Lot. And I think that if Abraham can engage God, he can engage anyone in a negotiation. Verses 14 and 15 was the reply from Ephron. Ephron answered Abraham, "Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. But what is that between you and me? Bury your dead." You see, Ephron was still dancing. He was kind of like enjoying the whole thing, right? What he was saying is, "We're brothers. Come on. Let not this small sum of money spoil our relationship." That was what he was saying. But 400 shekels of silver, that was a crazy price to pay. Remember, from the time of Abraham to the time of David, 500 years. And David bought the threshing floor from a Jebusite named Arauna for only 50 shekels of silver. And we know over time, property prices always appreciate. Am I correct? All right. My lousy HDB flat, I shouldn't say that. My small HDB flat, we bought it about 200,000, almost 300. All right. Today is almost double, triple. Property prices appreciate. And yes, we do not know how big was that field. We don't even know how valuable is that land. But it certainly was an enormous sum of money to pay. And Ephron could still be saying, "Oh, come on, it's just a small amount. Don't worry, we shouldn't be arguing over this. We are brothers." And he ended up by saying, "Go bury your dead." Second time he said it. Why did he repeat this? I think it was his way of telling Abraham, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock, you know. You can't hold on to a dead body. You got to bury it. And your time is running out. He was really smart. And clearly here we see Ephron and the elders taking advantage of Abraham's predicament. And they were digging deep into him, gouging him for every cent he had. And everybody at the city gate knew it. But again, here we have the father of faith, calm, cool, and collected, like Clint Eastwood. He can't show his frustration, or he would dishonor Ephron in the negotiation. He can't be screaming at him and say, "What, you're trying to rip me off or what?" He can't do that. So what did Abraham do? Verses 16 to 19 tells us. Verse 16, Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. So Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field, was deeded to Abraham as his property in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Afterward, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is at Hebron in the land of Canaan. I don't know what you see here, but here a couple of phrases that's repeated from the beginning. In the hearing of the Hittites, in the presence of all the Hittites, it is to tell us that everything was made publicly, legally, and everybody agreed to it. The other thing we see here was that Abraham willingly paid up a huge sum of money, again showing his faith in God. Why? Because God told him, you are coming back. You are coming back. Not you, your descendants. 400 years later, that was the promise that Abraham was clinging to. In the same way, we remember Jeremiah, just before the invasion of the Babylonians, and before the war, land prices, zero, almost. Nobody wants it. Who wants to buy the land when war is brewing? But Jeremiah bought to tell the Israelites that God promised to bring us back again. So Jeremiah bought the land. And here, similarly, Abraham bought the land. And Ephron was elated. He must have thought that he struck gold or he struck oil, both on the same day. And the elders, like we said earlier, they were equally happy because the property prices just skyrocketed. But little did they know that this is the beginning of their end. This was the beginning of their end. And Abraham did not cheat them. He paid him 400 shekels of silver according to the official weight that the merchants were using. He didn't use his own weighing machine, right? And he paid every cent. And everything in the field, which was near Mamre, and the trees that were bordering the field, they were all signed over legally to Abraham as his property. That is important. The property now belongs to Abraham. But we have another strange verse. Verse 20. Verse 20 is like redundant. It is repeating again. Because verse 20 says, so the field and the cave in it were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. It's repeating. And this, we could have struck out this last verse because it was unnecessary. The whole story could have ended at verse 19. But you know what? Verse 20 is so critical. It is important because the whole point of chapter 23 is not about the burial of Sarah. But the main lesson of chapter 23 is to show that Abraham has confirmed once and for all that his family will call Canaan home, just as God has directed him. God told him, leave your country, your relatives, and go to a place that I will show you. And this is exactly what he did. Because you and I know that you and I do not bury our loved ones in a foreign place. We always bury our loved ones in a place we call home. But what is critical here is to notice that God intentionally repeated twice that the land was deeded to Abraham in verses 17 and 18, the first time, and then again here in verse 20. meaning now that Abraham owns a piece of land. And this signals the beginning of the transfer of the land from the Canaanites to Abraham. Ephron and the elders, they thought that they were smart. But they have legally and officially sealed their own doom. God sealed the title deed of the land over to Abraham, so that he's now no longer a landless sojourner, a landless foreigner, a landless traveler. But now he has gained a foothold into the land, beginning with the grave. Beginning with the grave. And through this grave, God opened the door to the land for Abraham. Interestingly, Moses, who lived some 500 years after Abraham, Moses, when he was giving the law governing the ownership of fellow Israelites as servants, meaning in those days, there are Israelites who would sell themselves as servants if they are in financial difficulties. And they can sell themselves for a number of years. And that is calculated according to the year of Jubilee. And in the year of Jubilee, all the owners of the servants, I don't call them slaves, they must release their fellow Israelites. So when he was giving the law in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 41, Leviticus chapter 25, verse 41, in the NASB translation, it reads, he, meaning this person who sold himself as a servant, an Israelite, he shall then go out from you, he and his sons with him, and shall go back to his family, and he may return to the property of his forefathers. Notice here, Moses said that an Israelite who sold himself to you, another Israelite, in a year of Jubilee, you must release him, and he will go back to the property of his forefathers. Now remember, when Moses said this, it was at least 40 years before they entered Canaan. 40 years before. And it was even before it's only after they entered, then Joshua, after fighting the Canaanites, then he started to divide the land. But that didn't happen yet. And yet, Moses told them that the property there belongs to their forefathers. Who are their forefathers? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right? So there we have it. Even Moses acknowledged, tells us that land is their property, which Abraham by faith purchased. So, by the end of the book of Genesis, we have six people buried there. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Leah. And what does this tell us? That to Abraham, this is now his adopted home. And that's where he's going to stay, and his descendants, by faith. And this represents, this tells us how God's redemption plan was moving forward, as outlined in the Abrahamic covenant. We saw that last week, and we saw that some sometime back in chapter 12. And if you were to look at the Abrahamic covenant, the three things that God promised to Abraham was he will have a people, the Israelites, coming through Isaac. And then God is going to give them the land, Canaan. And through Abraham, the whole world will be blessed. And this blessing, we know it is coming in and through Jesus Christ. But if you were to look at these three, the people, Isaac is already here, so we can take the land, starting, take for the rest of Genesis. We're going to see how God is going to unveil to us his plan of bringing the Messiah. Into the picture. But at the same time, also we're going to see how the line from the line of Isaac, Jacob, and then through the 12 tribes and through Judah, which we will study. So I just want you to see that the whole of Genesis is actually captured in this simple template. Three things which God is working on, and he's going to reveal them a bit at a time. We know the blessing has come, and we're so privileged. And it has come in and through the person of Jesus Christ. But the frightening part is that now God is going to redeem the land. God is going to redeem the land. This earth, God is going to take back because it belongs to him. And you and I, we're seeing it in our lifetime today. And just like in chapter 23, we saw how wicked the Hittite culture was. And it got extremely wicked over the next 400 years, that God cannot bear their sins anymore. And God would have to destroy them through Joshua. And Joshua was instructed to kill them or to drive them out of the land. But it doesn't change the fact that we are just like living in the days of Abraham. And our world today has become so wicked that our Creator God, who owns this earth, he will also have to destroy the whole human race. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Look at our world today. It is in a chaos. And yet we find today frail, finite, sinful human beings trying to fix our broken world system. And it's not going to happen. Take, for example, problems with our economy, our politics, our social crimes, ecology. Nobody can fix that. We can try, but it cannot be done. And I've not even mentioned morality or religion. How wicked this world has become. Jesus spoke of famine, wars, diseases, earthquake. And the worst part is false teachers. False teachers in the last days will have a heyday. And many of us will be deceived. Can our world leaders solve all these problems? And the answer is no. Can you solve those problems? No, of course not. Can you even solve one of those problems? And the answer is still no. And all these problems, all this chaos started with men rejecting Jesus as God in their lives. That's the reason. But nobody believed that. They tried to build barrages to prevent the sea from coming in. The Bible tells us one day, even islands will disappear. And this planet will all go up in a ball of fire. It is inevitable. It will happen. There's nothing you and I can do to stop it or to change it, even for a little. But the good news is this. Jesus didn't ask us to solve all these problems. It will happen. It will come. But Jesus has specifically instructed all of us. He has told us as to how we should live our lives in these last days. Jesus said that we are to live holy lives. And then we are to follow him and make disciples. The book of Genesis ends with a full tomb. Full, six people. In chapter 50, Jacob will be the last person to be buried there. But all four Gospels ended with an empty tomb. An empty tomb. Jesus has conquered death and he has taken away its sting, meaning because of his victory, because he is God, we need not fear death or the grave. I hope that you and I will be encouraged, that you and I will not be paralyzed by all the evil that is going on in this world. But we'll be focused on what we can change. Ourselves and the people around us. One soul at a time. God bless.